Hello and welcome once again from me, Jenny Devitt, to this week's Countryside Matters. Do you remember how we all rather poked fun at the King when he was Prince Charles and liked to talk to plants? He may still do so, of course, but now science has found he may have a point. Dr. Stuart Thompson will be telling us about plant hearing. Plants have other senses and hidden means of communication too, and Mike Burks of the Gardens Group has some fascinating things to say about those. Plants, of course, are the basis of our food chain, and much of what we grow needs synthetic fertiliser, and as we all know, the Iran-US war is casting a long shadow over supplies of that. George Hosford shares his thoughts. And we'll round off today's programme by hearing from Ellie Maguire, a West Dorset member of the hugely popular Hawkstone Farmers Choir, which just won Britain's Got Talent. First to plants, which we've discovered can communicate in ways we never dreamt of not so long ago. Science is increasingly revealing the fascinating world of plant communication, and great strides have been made in research over the last few decades. Mike Burks of the Gardens Group looks back to when he was a horticultural student.
It's interesting. So we had a university reunion last year, a couple of years ago perhaps, and one of our friends was saying that she felt that everything that we learnt at university was now completely wrong. And I'm not sure that's entirely true, but what she was meaning was things like we just imagined that plants grew sort of independent of each other, had no knowledge of each other, and until they started competing, I guess, water and nutrients and light, and then that affected each other. But of course, the huge amount of work and discoveries taking place over the last few years particularly, which just shows that that's not true and how much plants do interact with each other in all sorts of ways.
So what is the principal method of communication? Is it via the root system of the plant?
Well, I think that that's probably the case. So there's so much is now being understood about the role of mycorrhizal fungi. So this is fungi that they don't look like mushrooms and toadstools, but fungi that are in slime or in strands in the soil. And there's quite a lot of them that will connect with the plant root and go off down into the soil and collect water and nutrients and bring it back to the plant in exchange for some sugar. So it's a symbiotic relationship. But not only that, but that mycorrhizal fungi will then connect to another plant. Now, you can imagine that happening with plants of the same species, but actually it's also happening with plants of different species as well. And I think in one of David Attenborough's recent series, they were touching on this, where plants in a forest that are very tall, so the tallest trees, being able to collect and create a nutrient that plants much lower down were not getting the same level of sunlight and sharing with them. And also things like deep-rooted plants bringing nutrient from way down in the soil up for shallower rooted plants to use. So there's sort of this interaction. So I think the soil is the main place it's probably happening.
So that makes it sound like a community, doesn't it? You know, because these are, if they're not the same species, why would they necessarily help each other?
Well, exactly that. So it is then more of a community. Now, whether that's, I don't know, something that's being done consciously or whether it's just happened, but then I guess, you know, evolution's like that, isn't it? We imagine that we're doing things consciously, but actually it's probably just instinct that we are just too ignorant to understand. So that sharing of and working as a community, and of course that's, you know, we now with the understanding of the need for pest and disease control without using chemicals for lots of wonderful reasons, but the sort of companion planting and rediscovering that, and of course that's all about plant communities and how they work with each other to sort of to keep each other safe. And so that's sort of part of it, that if we were to not be so blind to these things, we would actually understand how plants can look after each other.
Well, we'll come back to that in a moment, because that's about chemical communication, isn't it? Now, you mentioned that the mycorrhizal will be linking different species within, say, a woodland. Are they sending the same nutrients?
Well, that's an interesting one, but probably not, because different plants have different demands. I would think almost certainly it would be either the nutrients are available and plants are just taking different things, or that maybe there are, you know, the range of species of fungi, mycorrhizal fungi, is huge. So it could well be. So, for example, one of the reasons that things like rhododendrons and azaleas and camellias don't thrive in our alkaline soils is not necessarily that they don't like alkaline soils, but the mycorrhizal fungi doesn't live in the alkaline soil that looks after the rhododendron azalea camellia. So that's one of the reasons. So actually, you know, taking a plant out of its habitat, it's not necessarily the pH of the soil that is affecting the rhododendron, but actually it's the pH of the soil that's affecting the mycorrhizal fungi. So not allowing the plant to sort of naturally gather its nutrients.
So saying that that you're speculating that it's not, can't really use the word conscious act on the part of the mycorrhizal to send nutrients to the plant, but the plant, the different species, taking what they needed, makes it sound a bit like, you know, going around the supermarket.
And yes, I had a little buffet.
Food that you like.
High class buffet. Well, maybe it's like that. But it's interesting because the communication then in other ways, and I think that there's things, and we touched on it before, where, you know, plants responding to attack by pest, you know, and the great example I think you told me about was the giraffes and acacia, where when an acacia tree gets nibbled by a giraffe, then it will then put out toxins so the giraffe doesn't find it tasty anymore. And it does it relatively quickly, but not just for its own branches and leaves, but actually for its neighbours as well. And so the giraffe then will move on quite a distance, not even bothering to taste those other leaves, because they know that they'll already be nasty tasting to them. So moving on. So extraordinary that that happens. But I guess, again, why would we imagine that it wouldn't? You know, because, you know, plants have been around as long, if not longer, than we have. And
far longer, I think.
Yeah. Have adapted and will, you know, inevitably will come up with solutions to look after themselves. Otherwise, you know, that poor acacia would be devastated very, very quickly. So,
But the whole business of chemical communication amongst plants is fascinating, isn't it? Because you get the example of a forest where trees might be under an aphid attack, and
yes,
they can release chemicals,
yep,
to attract the predators, the ladybirds.
Absolutely, yes, yeah, to attract the ladybirds and also to repel the aphid as well. So work in harmony. And then lots of things, of course, the scent of plants is, we imagine that's just to attract insects for pollination, but almost certainly is for other reasons as well, sort of communicating, particularly with, you know, controlling pest and even disease, I guess, as well. There's some evidence that it's warning of drought too. Can't quite work out how that would happen, but nevertheless, it's you know, it's not beyond the realms of imagination. But yes, yeah, really interesting. And and then of course other bits like the plants responding to sound. And I guess it's sound that we imagine sound, but actually it's vibrations, of course, that is probably what's happening, part of which we hear a sound and others is movement. But I guess, again, you know, that's why would they not have adapted to be able to respond to those things. And it's interesting, I remember when I was working for Knockcuts Nurseries in Suffolk, part of my training was a student, and there was an experiment there using vibrations running through the wires that were holding the trees up in the field, getting them to just vibrate slightly, and it made the trees put on more roots and stiffen up the stems, because the trees were just responding to that stimulation. I guess it was sort of mimicking movement, and so making sure the tree was much more robust as a result. I don't think anything ever came of it commercially, but it was an interesting experiment, and Yeah, just showed how they respond to those things.
And I understand, Mike, that there's experiments going on in greenhouses to get plants to communicate or to be able to communicate with the plants in order to stimulate growth or whatever it might be.
Well, yeah, so it's quite a lot of, the greenhouse technology now is just so extraordinary, and being able to control the environment. Of course, quite a lot of that commercial production is sort of very much monocropping, so that's how it has its issues. But they're using biological control in those situations, hardly any tomatoes, cucumbers, peppers, in that sort of situation would have any chemical used on them other than fertilizer. But yes, there's just a sort of understanding and triggering responses from plants in that way, I think, is lots and lots of work going on.
Of course, the one thing we haven't touched on is that one that is so much more obvious to all of us, which is perfume, fragrance that plants give off in order to attract pollinators.
Yeah, absolutely. And you think about this, different times, I often wonder why something might be scented in the winter months when there's nothing around to smell it. And sometimes that's because we've imported it from, so it just flowers at the same time of year, so in its native habitat would be attracting an insect. But I think there's an awful lot of effort to put in just to attract pollinators, or actually now, of course, it would be a competitive advantage for them to attract us, because then we're more likely to cultivate that plant and plant it, even purchase it from the garden centre.
And of course, there's also, you kind of touched on it last time we spoke about couch grass and elder.
Yeah.
It's not all one big happy family
out there in
the plant world, is
no.
it? And so are elder and couch examples of plants that actually, could you say that they communicate to the plants growing around them to clear off.
So it's collectively known as allelopathy. So it's plants working against each other. So couch grass is a classic example, not just the way it grows as it can find its way in amongst plants, but also when you break it up, it you propagate it, so it's very difficult to get rid of. But actually what it's doing is exuding a hormone weed killer effectively from its roots, which actually nobbles the plant that it's growing in amongst. There's lots of other things that do it, but you can use plants against each other. So pot marigold is very, very good. It can be used as to eradicate mare's tail. So mare's tail, very, very tough prehistoric weed, very difficult to control. But planting marigold in amongst it, pot marigold, calendula, will eradicate it through exactly the same reasons. So hormones from the roots. And then there's other plants, like elder, which sort of does block other things from growing. It's quite an extraordinary plant. The amount of folklore there is about elder is probably more about elder than any other plant. And they used to plant it next to dairies and houses in order to stop insects from coming into the dairy or into the house. The flower, when they're in flower, it can be used to be dragged through fields of rape to sort of nobble the rape beetle. And its spongy bark is a fire retardant, so it's a very, very clever thing. And also can be used to cure warts by rubbing a stick of elder on your warts.
I must try that one.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
does sound a bit like a sort of a medieval witch's remedy.
Well, it does, yeah. So it's wart on my knee, go away, 1, 2, 3, and that's it.
I've never heard that one.
No, well, there we are.
Did you used to chant that when you were a small boy?
Yes, yeah, well, its ability to cure things means that it has to rhyme with 3. So anyway, knee, can't think of anything else.
I'll leave you to ponder on that one. Yeah. Just finally, Mike, I was thinking about sound, plants and sound, communication sound. I'm wondering whether, the quaking aspen, whether those rustling leaves in the breeze any biological underpinning, any reason for them to do that.
It could well do, couldn't it? Because there are, aren't there some trees that specifically do that, and that there has to be some reason why it's happened, just not a response. But of course, quite a lot of willows are like that, and they're, you know, willows containing salicylic acid, with, you know, which is the basis of aspirin. But I was reading something just the other day to say that the creaking of some branches is a warning to other trees that that it is windy and they need to stiffen up. And, you know, trees can, you know, their growth, when times are good, when there's plenty of water, plenty of warmth, they'll grow like mad. But actually that's quite often soft and floppy growth, and so they do have the ability to stiffen up under certain conditions. But yeah, but it may well be. Whether it's actually sound in, you know, the way that we hear it, or whether it's, you know, the frequency, the vibrations that are doing it, I don't know. But anyway, it's interesting.
So in effect, actually, plants and their communication is far more sophisticated than we ever really realised.
Yeah, and I think it's probably, it's probably our arrogance, isn't it, to just imagine that we're the best, and so that we are, anything else is doing something that we could have done ourselves already. But of course, it's not that way round, is it? And, you know, so many things have, you know, and so many cures for ailments that we have can be found in nature. There's the interesting one with you, and as a cancer treatment, paclitaxel. And first of all, it was made using hedge cuttings, and then they started to make it synthetically, but discovered that the synthetic version wasn't as powerful as a cancer drug as the natural extract from yew hedges. So return to that, I think.
Mike Burks, Managing Director of the Gardens Group. I came across a fascinating article online recently about hearing in plants. The author, Dr. Stuart Thompson, was prompted to write the article by recently published research work from a team of scientists at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, the renowned MIT, stating that they had found the first direct evidence that plant seeds and seedlings can sense sound in nature. I first asked Dr. Thompson to explain what sound is.
Well, sound is vibrations travelling through, we know it mostly for air, because that's what we hear are vibrations, where a molecule of air knocks the next molecule, so you get kind of a chain reaction. And that's a means by which energy can be moved from one place to another. But sound can also move through solid materials or through water as well. For example, when a dolphin is using echolocation or what have you. So it's a vibration, and it carries energy from one place to another. And with us, it makes the membranes in our ears vibrate, and we have specialized cells that detect that vibration and turn it into a nerve signal. And that's what we experience as hearing.
But talking to plants, of course, to encourage their growth or flowering, when did that idea first emerge?
I have no idea when it emerged. I mean, it's been sort of notorious for quite a long time. But yes, as many people do believe that talking to your plants helps. And I think we've got a body of research over the last few years which is suggesting that plants certainly are capable of responding to sound. And that it's not just random vibration that's causing that. You know, for example, there are a couple of instances where, for example, tobacco plants, they make nicotine, not to entertain those humans who enjoy it, but as an insecticide. And they make more nicotine if the tobacco plants next to them are being chewed on by caterpillars. And it seems that this is a specific sound response. If you give them a random sound, then they don't do it. If you expose the neighbouring plants, or you expose them to the sound of neighbouring plants being chewed on, then they make more insecticides to protect themselves. And it's not confined to nicotine, but that's quite an eye-catching example.
That's just to stop you there for a moment. That's extraordinary. I mean, to say that one plant growing a few feet away from the other, it has the sensitivity, the capacity to pick up a sound as small as a caterpillar munching.
Yes, it seems so. As I mean, these are experiments where we're sort of where the scientists involved are looking at the response, and certainly how that's happening is not clear in all cases. But yes, it is possible to not only to show that there is a response to the sound, but that it is specific, and that random sounds don't necessarily trigger the same effects. Now, and coming back to your question about talking, I think it's not unlikely that talking to your plants has some effect on them, but being sure whether they enjoy it or not is another matter.
Oh, it did all used to mock the king years ago when he was Prince Charles for talking to his plants. So I wonder what made him do that. I mean, what did he know that the rest of us didn't know?
I've no idea, but he has always been interested in the natural world. And I think we can maybe hope that that's something that may be coming through more in his... now he is a king.
So, Stuart, what are some of the more interesting, before we start talking about rice seeds and the research work that was done by MIT in America, what are some of the more interesting or even eccentric studies, to your knowledge, that have been done to show plant response to sound?
Well, I think I did do some checking around, because I kind of had a hunch people would have tried music. And I'm not necessarily sure it's the best study, but certainly one I mentioned in the conversation article is one where people have tried classical music and rock and roll on growing bok choy. This study is claiming that they grow better if you give them classical music, but do less well if with rock and roll, and I guess that might go with vibrations that are more regular as opposed to those that are maybe more irregular and more disruptive or bouncing off one another.
Sounds a bit like wishful thinking to me.
Maybe so. And as I say, I'm not necessarily sure that it's the best ever study, but it offers a sort of fun inroad into the subject to pick up this recent study. And certainly people for a while have been looking at synthetic sounds on germination and growth of seedlings. And this particular study is picking up on that and trying something that's maybe a little bit more relevant to the sound of a synthesizer, to the seeds involved.
So what did they do then?
Well, they were working with rice seedlings, and obviously that means that it's possible to grow them in shallow pools, sort of along the lines of paddies. And they started out by recording the sounds that a raindrop makes when it's falling into one of these puddles. And their claim is that the sound is actually astonishingly loud, sort of equivalent to someone shouting straight into your ear. But most of that's happening in frequencies that we don't hear, so either both too high and too low. So they recorded the sounds, and then they tested the effect of simulated rainfall, sort of light, medium and heavy fall, falling into the pools on the germination of the seeds. So are the seeds coming through? And it's a nice experiment from a scientific point of view, because all of the seeds are in water. You can be sure that it's not the effect of the rain making the seeds wetter, or the simulated rain making the seeds wetter. So you've got a nice baseline. And what they found is that the medium and the heavy rain caused the germination to come more quickly, caused the seeds to germinate more quickly. And then they went back and did some modelling of the sounds that they were recording on what they would do to the cells in the seeds. And what they were seeing is that one of the hypothesized structures for responding to sounds were likely to be made to bounce around the cells as a result of the heavier and the medium rain, but not the light rain.
How very interesting. Are you convinced by their arguments, by their experiments? Would you call it hearing?
The hearing is maybe the more controversial aspect. Certainly, I'm not surprised that we're seeing a response to sound, and that it's potentially a response matching a useful response. There's maybe a slight gap in that they're using modelling rather than direct measurement of the effects of the sound on the seeds. But again, it is plausible, and it goes with some nice previous work suggesting that these starch storing structures within the cells are needed to detect vibration. Now, plant cells usually use these to tell which way is up, because they are made heavier by the starch, and so the structures sink through the cells. But the ability to tell which way is up and the ability to detect vibration disappears in plants that can't make starch. So if you have mutated plants that can't make starch, they can neither tell which way is up and down, nor can they detect the vibration. And so that makes quite a nice story. So I'm persuaded by that.
Yes, if the poor plant can't tell which way is up, they have the roots growing up into the sky.
Yes. And I mean, they maybe have other cues to sort of direct the roots towards water or nutrients or whatever, but yes.
And that has yet to be found.
Yes. But whether we can call it hearing kind of depends on whether you need to have some sort of consciousness, whether you would just define this as almost an instinctive response. And that really brings us across into realms more of philosophy or psychology than necessarily of biochemistry.
That's potentially very interesting, isn't it? Because after all, it wasn't all that long ago when we finally admitted that actually other mammal species, aside from our own, it is distinct possibility that they have consciousness.
Yes. And I have to say that there are different definitions of consciousness, and I certainly wouldn't believe that plants have a sort of centralized sense of self in the way that we do. But I think in broader definitions, all living things have to be able to gather information about their internal and external states and make use of that. And I don't think it's too much of a stretch to say that this is something that you could call consciousness. And there are some experiments starting to suggest that even single cells, sort of in slime molds, for example, are able to some degree, navigate mazes in order to find food sources. And so I think maybe what we're seeing here is an aspect of something that is quite universal to life, and possibly even the best defining feature of what life is.
This sounds an absolutely fascinating future subject for very extensive research. But tell me, Stuart, is there any evidence to show that plants might be able to distinguish between, say, in the case of grass, the sound of a lawnmower, i.e. an enemy, or the welcome sound of a friend or something useful to the plant?
Well, I say they wouldn't necessarily have adapted to lawnmowers yet, but we do have this indication of response to pests. And there are a whole range of additional responses, not necessarily sounds, but smells or chemical signals. So yes, it is quite clearly one of the other things that we've known for a while is that when plants come under attack, either from a pathogen or from a pest, they will release a whole range of volatile molecules. You know, for example, the jasmine scent that gives jasmine tea its smell is one of them. And that neighbouring plants will respond to those molecules by beefing up their defences, making toxins or triggering their pathogen responses, their disease responses in advance. And so that's another suite of responses. And so not necessarily the sound of a lawnmower, but that smell of mown grass may well be triggering a panic in neighbouring plants.
So you mean to say, that was just lovely, do you mean to say then that some of the teas that we value, like jasmine, that's actually the reason that it has that particular flavour is it's a molecule that's been given off, a pheromone that's been given off by the plant to tell other plants beware.
It does other things as well, but yes, it seems to be one of its sort of key roles. Yeah.
How wonderful. Well, thank you so much. That's really lovely. It just so happens that I translated before COVID. I did a translation for a French wildlife production company. They were making a film about wolves. And one of the sequences was about this dead tree stump in the middle of a glade. And despite the fact that it had been long dead, apparently its relatives, its living relatives, were still sending nutrients through the mycorrhizal to its roots.
Yes, I mean, this is one of the other really interesting stories. And in fact, it looks as though this relationship with plants and fungi goes back to the very, very beginning, in that if you go back to some of the Schurte Rhine fossil beds from the very first organisms moving onto land, it's possible to see fungi associated with the plants. So before plants had roots, they had these symbiotic relationships with fungi. And they certainly, yes, we see most plants these days, at least if they're in established ecosystems, are interconnected by fungi, which are distributing resources and very likely information between the plants as well.
I guess this explains why plantations of non-related trees don't do as well as having related trees put in the ground.
To some degree, yes, although some researchers are of the view that this is one of the strengths to established ecosystems, that it isn't all the sort of stereotypical survival of the fittest competition, that ecosystems are cooperative as well. And that these cooperations can be not just within species and within relations, but between individuals and species. But what you have with these new plantations are monocultures, where you don't have these established mycorrhizal connections. You don't have an established system of...
Yes, they're being put into ground where there is effectively not very much.
Indeed, and the same would apply to monocultures of crops as well.
Dr. Stuart Thompson, who's senior lecturer in plant biochemistry at the University of Westminster. It is very much dragging on, isn't it? Although it does seem to have slipped down the priority list on the news, mercifully. I'm talking, of course, of the US-Iran war. Not only is this conflict driving up fuel prices, but it's also having a major impact on supplies of artificial fertilizer. Fuel price hikes have also meant the price of red diesel has shot up. This is what farm vehicles run on. It's diesel with a red dye added. Before we talked about fertilizer, I asked George Hosford to gaze into his crystal ball and say what changes farmers could make to reduce their use of red diesel.
Well, there are different ways of growing. Well, you'll remember that we're predominantly arable farmers, and that means we grow crops and we make our living from growing crops. As well as we have a few beef cattle, but it's a small proportion of our business. So traditionally, and we're talking on our farm more than 20 years ago now, every acre of the farm would be ploughed, which is a plough is a machine that you a static machine that you fix to the back of a tractor with a number of turn furrows on it, which when they're all put together turn the ground. When you're driving it along with it engaged in the soil, it turns over the soil, generally down to a depth of 6 or 8 inches, completely inverts it and buries any trash or grass or stubble that was on the surface of the ground and buries it in the bottom of the furrow. But what it also does is completely muck up the soil structure, upsets the worms, breaks all the worm holes that are in the soil and very useful for enabling air to get into the soil and for water to drain through the soil and for the worms to go up and down and drag the decaying plant matter down into the soil to rot it down in the depths of the soil, where it does the soil a lot of good and feeds the fungi that live in the soil as well. So ploughing is bad for many reasons, but it is also one of the big reasons is that it costs an awful lot because it is very slow. You can't drive very fast and you're moving an enormous tonnage of soil. If you imagine taking 8 inches across every acre of your farm, it's a massive tonnage of soil. I mean, I could work it out on an acre, or a hectare would be easier because it's metric. But so that requires energy, and that means not only the fuel that you put in the tractor, but the wear and tear on the tractor, the rubber tyres on the tractor, which because it's a heavy draft operation, the tyres are gripping hard to the ground, and if you've got stony ground like ours, they wear out faster, so you you burn more rubber. We used to get through a set of tyres every year on our ploughing tractor, whereas now they last 5 years. And if the time, the wages for the man or woman who is driving the tractor, and as well as the depreciation on the tractor, because you're clocking up much bigger hours, so it means you're going to be replacing your tractor more often, and the depreciation, i.e. the capital cost broken down to over the life of the tractor, will be higher as well. So a huge amount of cost there, which can be offset. But in our case, and many, many farmers, they reduced their tillage and gave up ploughing 20 odd years ago, but some farmers still do it, and they're the ones who could economise and do it in a different way.
So what's the alternative then to ploughing? I mean, we've been ploughing for thousands of years, of course, haven't we?
Yes, but old-fashioned horse ploughing, because the horse is only one horsepower, and the ploughs they used only really engaged with 3 or 4 inches of the soil, as I understand it. And if you watch match ploughing with horses these days, they don't go very deep compared to a tractor-mounted plough. That means you're turning over less soil, therefore less requirement for power.
And less destructive as well to soil structure.
Less destructive to soil structure. And from time to time, the horse would probably manure the crop as he's going along as well. So what you can do these days is to use other machines other than a plough, whereby you don't expect to bury the trash on the surface, but you rely on chemicals such as glyphosate to kill the trash or weeds that are growing on the surface, or grass if it was grass the year before. You rely on the chemical to kill those things, and then the plough, which the plough previously would have buried, if you see what I mean. And so the dying remains of those weeds or grass remain mixed into the surface by a cultivator machine of one sort or another, whether it is based on tines or disc. Tines are like a stick stuck into the ground and dragged along, which just breaks the soil and stirs it up a bit. And a disc is, if you envisage a soup bowl or a dinner plate, which is a bit bowed, and you set it at an angle, at the right angle to the ground that you're pulling it through, it will penetrate and turn over to a degree the soil, all depending on how close together your dinner plates are and how deep you've set it. And it's all about the angle that you pull the machine at.
Let's come back to fertiliser. These artificial fertilisers obviously very prone, as we can see at the moment, very clearly, very prone to global upsets and, you know, lack of supply. So what's the alternative? Could we be using more slurry from cattle? Could we be using more digestate from digesters? Could we be using more slurry from sewage plants?
Well, you can be doing all those things, but they're all being done already. And there simply isn't enough. And the problem we have, and I'm looking at a graph which I could share with you, but it's not really very helpful in a radio interview.
Bit difficult for me to see it, I have to say.
It is, but maybe I should have sent it to you beforehand. But the point that it demonstrates is that since about the 1930s, world population, if it had been unsupported by the use of synthetic fertilizers, world population, it is estimated, would be less than 4 billion, whereas the presence of the availability of artificial fertilizers, synthetic fertilizers, has enabled the world population to be double that. So this is our problem. We have, and of course, artificial fertilizers are entirely derived from natural gas, fossil fuels, in other words, hence they cause an awful lot of climate damage. And so because the world population is that high, there simply aren't enough animals in the world or enough, you know, slurry from animals in the world or manure or digestate from anaerobic digesters. I mean, that would be a tiny amount in comparison to the whole. Or even human sewage sludge, which is another issue altogether. A lot of farmers won't have sewage sludge on the farm. We've given it up because we don't like what comes along with it, because people insist on putting all sorts of stuff down the toilet, which ends up at the sewage works, a lot of it being hormonal, the birth control pill, for one thing. And you end up with, you imagine how many people might be taking birth control or hormone treatment of any kind. That ends up through the urine or people's other exudates, ends up in the sewage system and then ends up on the land. What sort of effect are those things going to have? Not to mention all the other medication that people take. So it's a bit scary, not to mention heavy metals and what have you, which might come from industry.
So really not a little option at present, from what you're saying, to using.
We're in a hell of a fix. We're in a dreadful fix. And we need to wean ourselves off this path. So for those who followed our journey into regenerative farming, which you might have done by reading my blog, and some of the readers listening might have read some of my previous pieces in the Dorset, in the previous, the Blackmore Vale, the BV online, which is now the Dorset Life. We have for the last 5 years been trying to reduce our reliance on artificial fertilizers, enable our soils to be healthier and take advantage of more latent yet untapped fertility that lies in the soils themselves, which is in various ways suppressed by the application of huge amounts of artificial fertilizer and chemical. So we're trying to get back to a healthy soil which is more self-sustaining and probably doesn't produce as much food as it did when we were lashing on the synthetic fertilizer.
It does kind of seem to, we do seem to go round in circles, don't we, on this one? I mean, I can quite understand that you wouldn't want to put lots of human sewage on the land because of all the things that, you know, that go into it.
Yeah, it's got to go somewhere. And we are charged for it, but we were relying on it for quite a few. We probably did it for 10 years and you can grow good grape crops after it. But in the end, we're worried about all these other things that are in it. The effect they might have on our crops, on the healthy biome of our soil, and that kind of thing. So what we are trying to find is a new normal using not none, but less input from the healthier soil. But we're just stretching the inputs further or making them work harder or something. But you know, there's no getting away from the fact that the yield is lower. But we are, first of all, we're a business. We've got to pay the rent and pay our employees and pay for all the other costs that go with running the business. And we've got to balance. We still got to make a living. So we're trying to find a new normal between the lower output and the cost of the input, the lower inputs. And some farmers would maintain that there isn't. They're already at the best level possible, and it's down to each of us to make those calculations.
George Hosford, who was talking to me a few weeks ago. Finally, something that's happened recently that shone the national spotlight on our farming community. I'm talking about the recent win of TV's hugely popular Britain's Got Talent by the Hawkstone Farmers Choir. It's not been going very long, it's only 34 strong, and its singers come from almost all over the country. Dorset boasts two singers, Ben Chick from Sixpenny Handley and Ellie Maguire from Sanford Orcus. Ellie was asked to open the annual village fete, and that's where I caught up with her. She did her choir audition, she told me, in a slightly unusual location.
We sent in videos to an email address that was given, though I actually did mine in the car because I had a young baby at the time, so didn't want to wake the baby, so I just sang a few lines of a hymn.
Wait a minute, you sat in the car?
I was sitting in the car.
Which for a singer, of course, is, you can't really go,
no,
you can't keep
true.
Deep breath, can you?
No.
How did you manage that?
Well, so they said it could be very relaxed. I think it was just to get an idea, so we just had to say what our link to farming was and then sing a few lines of it. They asked for a hymn. I'm trying to remember what I did now. I think I did I Vow to Thee My Country, I think.
So, but you could choose what you sang
yeah.
for the audition.
Yeah.
Now you're soprano?
I am, yes, yeah.
Are you a high soprano?
I would have called myself a mezzo-soprano, but I've ended up doing the high parts, yeah. I think by default, because none of the other sopranos wanted to.
And Ellie, have you always been a singer?
So I sang through school, and then I would have loved to have followed it sort of professionally, but didn't like the idea of moving to London or anything, and I didn't like the idea of leaving the farm or the horses, so I never did that. So to find an avenue for it's been so great.
So how did you hear about this choir?
So it was actually a casting call on social media, and then a few people sent it to me. Say my son was about 4 months old at the time, so I decided to answer the advert with the audition tape.
And how long did you have to wait until you heard whether you were in the choir or not?
Oh dear, I can't actually remember. I'd say it was probably a month or so. They had, I think, about 500 applicants. So Simon and Lizzie, who are our musical and choir directors, trilled through all these videos, I think. And originally there was a Core 10. So I was actually picked as part of the Core 10 that did the recordings for these original adverts that we did. And then that was going to be played over the top of the film, so we recorded it. But then when we all got together with the so-called extras, they were all incredible singers as well. So we all ended up singing, I think, on the adverts live rather than using our recordings from the day before. So, yeah, that's
Elias, terrific to have been selected out of 500, isn't it? And the choir is, and you say you were initially just 10 of you singers to sing these. The choir was formed originally then just to do these ads for Jeremy Clarkson's Hoxton Beer and Cider.
Exactly, yep. So it started as a bit of a marketing, you know, gimmick, I guess, campaign with some slightly sweary songs about lager and cider, which was so much fun. We just laughed for the whole thing. It was so fun. And that's how it started. But then I think it just some sort of magic happened when we all got together and sang. It sounded great and we all just had a great time. And you can imagine all 30, 40 farmers in one room that all do enjoy singing as well. Had so much to talk about.
Yeah. I mean, that's lovely, isn't it? Because, you know, not only did you have the joy, the pleasure of singing in common, but you were all from a similar environment. You were all from the farming community.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's ended up turning into almost a bit of a movement. Certainly, I know, it's a bit stereotypically, sort of farmers aren't that good at talking to each other and communicating, and especially the older generations. And we've got, so I think the youngest is 27 and the oldest is 75, I want to say. So we've got wide generations, wide geographic locations, and everyone has just started to open up and talk to each other. And going from that first advert where it was all a bit of fun and timid, now we've become this really tight-knit community, which has been really special.
That's lovely, isn't it? So you've obviously got things in common with people from, they might be farming up in Northumberland or I don't know, Essex, but you've all got this thing in common, haven't you? The love of the land.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we've got quite a few Welsh. That's, you know, they all have the voices.
We all know the Welsh. They're reputed for their singing.
So we have got, I think it's something like 12 members. I might be wrong there, but something like that are Welsh. And then say we've got a girl from Northumberland, and then down here in Dorset. So it's huge spread.
And are all the counties in the country represented or not?
No, not quite. No, there's quite a few actually from sort of the Midlands and Cotswold area that are luckily for them nice and local to Jeremy. But then I'd say a few, Wales, Herefordshire, Northumberland, Dorset.
So you started as a core group of 10 to sing these sweary songs about beer and cider for Jeremy Clarkson. And then you, so whose idea was it to make a bigger choir then and actually to form something, make something more formal, the Hoxton Farmers Choir?
I think it was a little bit collective. So when we went to film the advert, we had another sort of 20 or 30 farmers that were supposed to be extras and in the advert originally. So you could apply to either be a singer or an extra. And it said the singers had to be strong singers, the extras just needed to hold a tune. But actually, everyone was a strong singer.
But they were better than just holding a tune.
Yeah, absolutely, definitely. So, and as I say, we all sang on the day and it sounded great. So I think between sort of the producers, the musical directors and ourselves, obviously we were really keen to carry on, and then I think everyone else involved in the production thought, hang on, this could be something we've got here.
So when was this sort of formal, the choir then formally created? Was it just last year?
Oh yeah, so the adverts were filmed sort of this time last year, I think maybe May. So just over a year. So we've not been together long.
And whose idea was it to enter into Britain's Got Talent?
Again, I think it was a little bit collective. And when we first heard the idea, I think we all thought, well, a few actually didn't do it because they thought it was a little bit of a gimmick, and then I think probably regretted it now. But most of us just sort of thought, well, you know, it'd be a fun day out, something to, you know, story to tell, and weren't expecting it to turn into anything really. So it's just, it's one of those things that's just kept growing and growing.
So a big surprise a few weeks ago when you were automatically selected. Was it Amanda Holden who jumped up in delight?
Yeah.
And you were automatically selected straight through to the semi-final.
Yeah, exactly. So we actually filmed that. That was in November. So it was a while between the auditions and the semi-final. So we had to keep... Oh, sorry, between the auditions and it being shown on television. So I think it was shown in March. So we all had to keep quite quiet between November and March that we'd been on and got the golden buzzer. So, yeah.
Now, given that most choirs are very much local, aren't they? And there you are, scattered all over the country. Where and how do you get together to rehearse?
We don't very often, which is a shame. We'd love to do it more, but obviously everybody has their farms and their lives that they need to carry on with. But what we did before the audition was got together for, I think, 2 days in the Cotswolds, because it was just the most central place for everyone to get to. So we just did 2 days before the Golden Buzzer audition. And then we did another 3 days, again, met up actually in Oxfordshire, it was, before the semi-finals. And then before the final, we literally just arrived in London on the Thursday. I think it was the Thursday afternoon. So we rehearsed Thursday afternoon, Friday, and then did it on Saturday. So it was all a bit of a whirlwind.
Did you have stage fright before the performance in the final?
The final, actually, I think, was the most sort of relaxed that we've all been. I'm not exactly sure why. I don't think I felt nervous in any of the performances, more overwhelmed, I think. When I've sung before, it's been sort of, you know, churches or concerts where everybody's quiet and paying attention and watching. And in Birmingham, the crowd was going crazy as we walked on, which was just so overwhelming. I've never experienced anything like that. So it was, yeah, just took your breath away a little bit, which isn't ideal when you're about to sing. And then when it got to the semi-final, we were all very emotional. It's quite an emotional song, and we'd been sort of sharing stories about who we were singing for and things like that, who we were thinking of when we were singing. So I'm quite an emotional person anyway, so that got me. And then for the final, I think we just all knew that it was the final time we were going to be singing on that huge stage, or possibly not now, but in that competition, it was the last time we were going to get to sing. And we loved the song. It was written for us, so it was more just sort of excitement to share it, and I think we all just enjoyed it a lot more. And I guess we'd experienced the atmosphere the week before, so we were a little bit more comfortable up there.
And of course everybody's made quite a thing about the fact that you sang a new song for the final, which was considered, I guess, quite risky by a lot of people, including, I believe, Simon Cowell.
Yeah, so the song we heard to start with in one of our rehearsals, and Simon Gwilliam, who's been our musical director, he was sort of inspired by us and getting to know us, and wrote it for us. I do think he's actually written a few songs, and then ultimately he took the ideas for what we might do to Britain's Got Talent, just, you know, we have to run it by them. And I think he wanted to do one of the other ones, but they said, no, this is the song you've got to do, which was amazing, because I think it's quite rare to be allowed to do an original. They often encourage you not to do that, but they heard that song and said, no, you absolutely have to do that.
Which... And of course, it meant an awful lot to the wording, didn't it?
Absolutely.
Meant an awful lot to all of
yeah,
you.
Yeah, there's, I don't know if you've listened to all the words, but there's a line in it, "On land we sowed our dreams," just gets me every time.
It's a beautiful line.
Isn't it? Really, really beautiful. Yeah. When we very first heard it, I said that to Simon, that line just, I mean, it's all beautiful, but that line really got me, and he's remembered that. He said it when we were all celebrating afterwards, that he remembered.
And you managed to carry on singing through that emotion.
Yes, yeah. Yeah.
And of course, one of the things that you know, it's been widely said, hasn't it, that one of the really beneficial things about having formed this choir and gone on national television is that it's raised the profile of British farming and made a lot more people realise that it can be a very lonely job, a difficult job, and you know, a lot of farmers suffer from mental health issues.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's been one of the most special things about it, I think. It's obviously a journey we didn't know we were going to go on, and I think the fact that it's putting farming in the media in a positive way has meant a lot to everyone. We've been getting lots of messages of support, which has been incredible, and personally I've had a few that from people saying that they were in a bit of a dark place, and actually seeing us doing this has given them a little bit of hope and taking our message on board and speaking out and things. So it, just to think that we've made some sort of a difference. I think when we started, I sort of said if we make a difference to one person, then I'm pleased. And actually, we've received so many messages. So it's couldn't be happier for the difference it's making.
You've made a difference to an awful lot of people, I think, haven't you? And raising the profile of British farmers at a particularly difficult time. Really matters, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely. I think so. Everyone needed something to celebrate at the moment, I think.
And so now, of course, come towards the end of the year, you'll be back up in London again performing in the Royal Variety Performance, won't you?
Yes, yeah.
How do you feel about that one?
It's exciting. I can't believe that I'm going to be able to say I've sung at the Apollo and the... it's the Royal Albert Hall, isn't it, I think? I
can't even... in front of the King.
Exactly, in front of the King, yeah. Just crazy. Just things that dreams are made of, I think.
And beyond that, is that too far ahead to think what the choir might be doing?
Yeah, I mean, there's loads of ideas floating around, so it's definitely something that's going to continue. I think a few people have mentioned wanting to do Glastonbury, which would be very exciting.
That would be wonderful,
wouldn't
it? I think
it would be quite fitting to be a group of farmers singing on a dairy farm.
I suspect you might get invited.
I hope so. And then, yeah, after that, I think a lot's up in the air, but definitely we want to keep riding the wave and, as you say, keep bringing farming into the spotlight if we can.
Singer and dairy farmer Ellie Maguire, a member of the very popular Hawkstone Farmers Choir. And that brings us to the end of this episode of Countryside Matters. Thank you for listening, and thanks to the Gardens Group for its support of the programme. This is Jenny Devitt saying goodbye to you until next time. Bye-bye.